Bob, when you spent time with Marshall, spying on him, what have you, or being friends with him, did you ever get the impression he thought there was something special about you?
Yes.
Did he ever comment on that?
Yep. When I started going over to the St. Mike's Catholic Library, that he was part of the Catholic University, and they had the dew line, they had this old, battered lady. You had to pass her guardedness of getting to the archives, and I wanted to read the dew line. I didn't have the dew line. So I managed to get through for a couple of days, and then there was a wall. She was starting to get suspicious of me because I was grabbing the stuff and Xeroxing it. And she eventually noticed this. So I noticed her being suspicious, and then a few days later, it was a Monday night at the seminar, and this would be 1978 or so. And after the seminar, Marshall comes over to me, and he says, so Mrs. whatever her name, Mrs. Smith, Mrs. Smith says you've been dropping in. So then I knew, oh, okay, so she's been talking to him. And he said, she wanted to know who you were, Bob. Are you a student of mine? Are you authorized? And I said, yes, what'd you say? He said, you're no problem, Bob. You're not a problem. I told her that. So you're not going to have any issues when you go back. So I went back, and she didn't bother me, and I got to go there for the next few days and Xerox all the rest of it. You have to understand, this is being said in front of a bunch of students and people. And they, after, when he said that, after they all came up, what's he mean? Why is he saying you're no problem? And, they all wanted to know, because they knew some little bit of wink-wink was going on there. Because, actually, I was a problem. He knew it, because I was spying on him. So then, a little while later, I go to a seminar, and George Thompson says to me, Bob, I want to talk to you after. And I said, okay. That night was the night Trudeau came. And George stood there the whole time in the doorway staring at me. Here's all these students, people, a big crowd of people, most of them sitting on the floor. And there's Prime Minister Trudeau talking to McLuhan. And it's the first time you saw McLuhan not say much. He played the respect game. Okay, the Prime Minister's here, I'll shut up. So basically it turned out to be an interview of Trudeau. But the whole fucking time, George stood there with his arm folded, looking across the room at me, just staring at me. And he stood there like for an hour. After a while, I noticed him. I said, he's still looking at me. What's going on? And George just kept staring at me. So after it was all over and everybody's excited and Trudeau was there and then he left and he and Marshall went off to, well, I think they already had dinner, but I think they probably continued being together. Or not. Maybe the bodyguards. There were bodyguards there. They took Trudeau away. So I go to George and I said, so George, ignoring the fact he was staring at me, you wanted to talk to me. What is it? He said, no, nothing, Bob. Never mind. Not an issue. Okay, bye. I found out years later when he was a good friend of Nelson Thal's. And after Marshall died, I would meet George occasionally through Nelson. It was like 7 years later. And I found out that he was going to ban me from the coach house that night. He and Marshall, I don't know who prompted it, were very suspicious of me. He knew Trudeau was coming. So he wanted to watch me in relation to Trudeau to see if I would attack Trudeau. I don't know what. He just watched me like a bodyguard to see if I would do anything to Trudeau. And I passed the test, accidentally. I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything. I kept my cool. And George decided that I was all right and that they didn't have to ban me. So that was a drama. And that's what I mean, that I was a problem. Because I was the only one who showed up at every fucking thing. I never missed a meeting. And they brought strangers with me.
How did you, what was your cover? You weren't a student. Were you auditing the classes or the public
was
allowed
to
come in?
This is a famous Monday night seminar. It's open to the public.
Did you stand up and badger the speaker like you did with Thompson and Croker and those guys when you went to their
I never said
seminars?
A word. I went there for years and never said a word except one night, about 1976, he was talking about myth. And I said, the myth of the myth. And he said, no. And students laughed. They thought that was clever. And they go, no. And he says, no, Bob, that's a mirror image. So I said, oh, that's interesting. So I shut up. I never spoke again. Well, I never spoke before, but I wanted to say that. And I learned that, a myth of the myth is a mirror image. It's a visual statement. So that's the only time I spoke. But they got very suspicious that I never spoke. And in 78 and 79, when nobody was coming anymore, nobody cared, Marshall only had six students and things like that, I'd show up with strangers. strange people every week, and I would bring the audience. And after about a year of this, they started to wonder, what the fuck's going on here? Oh, we've only got Bob here, and he's bringing these strange people we don't even know. So Marshall probably got uncomfortable, and he and George schemed, and then they used the Trudeau event to observe me, and I passed the test, whatever it was. Then when I do the archives, when I get asked to do the archives, I find a box, box 22, with a file folder that had my name and it said McLuhan Archivist. They had decided that I was the only McLuhan Archivist around.
How personal did you get with Marshall?
Well, you can read some of them in the diary entries. I mean, I met him in the 50s, and he relied on me telling him whatever I thought I could tell him from the Secret Council intelligence world, which I always formed on that because he was very up on that, and he had a lot of sources himself, and he recognized me as a source. You know,
well, Marshall was aware of the power structure on the planet at that time, right?
Well, he talked about it. He wrote about it. And he made fun of them. He knew they were obsolete.
How knowledgeable was he about this network that you called the Secret Council of Ten?
He didn't know anything about it, and I never told him. He just figured I was CIA or something. But he talked about how the Pentagon built a global intercom. That's why they have police states all over the world. They had to have their military capabilities to mobilize instantly. So they had communication with every little place, nook and cranny all over the planet, ready to go for lockdown in some way if required. He knew that the United Nations didn't run anything. He knew a world government bureaucracy wouldn't run anything. He knew there was a global intercom. He wrote about it. And that's pretty well close to a Secret Council of Ten. That is a small committee that's hooked in, like on the phone. The whole world's run by a telephone, but the phone is hooked into every country that you need around the world. So he knew structurally there was a Secret Council 10, but he didn't know who they were, and he didn't care. Because he knew that in the end, just like my father knew, that it wouldn't hold the thing together. That Humpty had been put back together regardless of the bureaucrats.
And that's why your father took an interest in Marshall, because he knew that Marshall knew that also.
No, my father didn't know about Marshall. It was my father's employers who took an interest in Marshall when he published that first article in December 53.
How did your father know it wouldn't hold together?
Remember, he was not an oligarchy person. He was a butler. And he was brought in the 20s after the collapse of a good chunk of the oligarchy in World War I. He started working for his employer, which we'd been a family employed for 300 years. He saw the employer vulnerable for the first time. He saw the employer needed to use my father for intelligence work. So he watched them through the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s inside. And he could see what was going on in the world. It was not turning out the way his boss thought it was. And so you can read those diary entries in the late 50s where he starts telling me, you've got to figure out a way to get out of this situation. This is not going to last. It may end up pretty tragic. And then I have a whole series of quotes. So he just saw a reasonably intelligent person who's not hypnotized, who had no investment in the power, really, you know, was not hypnotized. Had to protect it. He didn't care whether it went or not. And so he could see the emperor had no clothes.
What was the vulnerability that he saw?
You could say the beginnings of machines coming alive and taking over in some inhuman way. That even Bill Joy and various people in, who worked and built Silicon Alley, now panic about, you know, that humans are...
You could see that in the 20s?
No, this is the late 50s. He saw it after Sputnik. Like, Sputnik was a shock, and then he watched the panic, and then he watched the information overload environment start in the early 60s, where the patterns that the Secret Council thought they had to control, the big picture, was useless and could not be controlled anymore. The effects had gotten out of hand. That's the bottom-up revolution on incitement of the 60s, including the LSD revolution, because the CIA couldn't control it. That was the exuberance of the 60s. That frightened all the elites, you know, including assassinating Kennedy because of that.
It wasn't exactly that the machines were taking over. It was that it was creating opportunities for new human beings to take power into their own hands.
Yeah, decentralized. Massive decentralizing on many levels. And you'll hear him talk about this in these recordings that I'm playing. He talks about the decentralism. Multi-consciousness is taking over. Dave Wirst used to say, I think it was in the Soviet Union, once the people realized they couldn't be conditioned, they couldn't be hypnotized by the strategies of power at that point, You can't hypnotize them again. So all through the 20th century, populations were getting dehypnotized from the old forms of powerful Rai principality hypnotism. When you're getting movies and radio and all the stuff coming at you, how could a small committee look at the footage of whoever the king was in 36 that abdicated? He gets on there and a little movie camera, and he's totally like a Lilliputian. He has no understanding of how to have, you know, movie presence or camera presence. And he just looks like a little thug, and he's trying to explain to his people the massive decision he's making to abdicate. So the media exposed these guys beyond what they realized. And, you know, Marshall said George Orwell's 1984 had happened by 1900 in terms of Big Brother taking over, and then somehow through fear, keeping it going. You know, the scene ends with the Winston guy, you know, with a cage with a rat in it threatening to bite his head off.
Orwell depicted oligarchy that could watch you through your television set. With all of the video cameras all around now that can video people in public and under all these different circumstances, that seems to reflect more of the Orwellian image.
No, because in 1984, the people are all scared shitless are being taped or watched. Nowadays, your 10-year-old's got his school gang from grade 6 running out there and taking their clothes off and saying, film us, I don't give a fuck. They're spitting right back at it. They got a little youthful conspiracy of, well, you know, you can't have obscene history in your life or the fact you did some porn, and they hold it over you. Well, we're going to all do porn right now. Put it out there so you can't control us. You can't bribe us. You can't blackmail us. This has been going on for 10 years. That's just in the little world of kids. They don't describe in the novels the public making fun of the surveillance.
However, people that have tremendous power don't care about those kinds of things anyway.
Yeah, they don't rule on that level. There's no satisfaction in having power. You know, the guy in Orwell's 1984 that runs Winston, he's a guy who has to stay in his office and run the world and be on top of everything. Where's the fun in that? You look at that movie, The Formula, with George Patton and Marlon Brando. In it, Adam, the Marlon Brando character who runs the oil business, the oil world, he tells George Patton, the cop, he says, you know, I wish I was like you. You know, you can go backpacking on the weekend. And this, I can't do that. I'm a bureaucrat, a harassed bureaucrat. There was no joy in the specialist of being a powerful person. Marlon Brando, that character, didn't have any time to listen to radio and jazz or opera on Saturday afternoon. You can't even enjoy the wealth that's in the media, the analog media, by the mid-50s, if you're a harassed bureaucrat. You're too involved with management in a paranoid scenario.
Well, if J.W. controls as much wealth as you say he does, he would be in the same position of having to manage it.
He has a lot of papers to sign. But I would say that he had done everything and been everywhere by 2005, and he's a guy looking for more. I think that he got what he asked for. He got Ion.
Yeah, but he also loves managing the details. He just gets all excited about it.
He manages the pennies. He doesn't care about the billions. He's worrying about someone getting 5 cents, and they should only get 3 cents. And he admits he's neurotic about that. Anyways, J.W., when I first knew him in 2006, he'd drive down the highway at 150 miles an hour with an escort. Once Ion came into his life, he stopped running around. I mean, he was a hectic guy, you know, doing all kinds of things, living fast, traveling a lot, hardly ever home. And when people saw how he wasn't doing that anymore, they said, well, what happened to JW? You know, because he was just staying home. Well, they didn't know what he was doing at home, which was talking to us and having Ion be around us, you know, every day. And that led to a whole bunch of new stuff. So he became a very different person. But he got what he wanted. He got the next level of wealth. He got the wealthiest wealth. He'd gotten all the other wealth and everything that came with it. He was bored with it. And he's a lucky guy. He was able to allow himself to get to the next level of wealth, which is Iondom. Many of the wealthy people in the world know about us. They are on the drops. They think a lot of J.W. They probably think he's one of us, and that fucking guy actually got out of our rut. You know, they're pretty impressed that he evolved out of it. I don't think Warren Buffett could do that. He's trying to, but he couldn't do what J.W. did. Ion didn't come to him. And J.W.'s just young. He's going to be 50 this year in August. Only 50.
That's why Bob bringing McLuhan to the surface is so fun, because here's a guy who's not fallen for any of it. He's got his own opinions and his own voice. And I happen to think he probably found something very valuable in the ritual of the Mass. I think he probably had it open doors of perception that may not have even been opened by the people who were performing the Mass. That's where I tend to feel a little bit in doubt about Bob's assertion that he was putting on the Catholic Church as some kind of a mask or a ruse or a trick.
No, he's putting on the bureaucracy. You can see it in the electric light and the medium, him analyzing the Mass and saying the Church doesn't even recognize what it means.
But
he had his version of Catholicism, but he wasn't following. He said, I never followed Catholic dogma or doctrine. He didn't believe in any of that. He had his own hyper-subjective version of Catholicism,
which was probably closer to the esoteric core of the true nature of the Mass.
Yeah. I want to say something about the 60s. The fact that Riley returned to the plane of essence in 67, there was a genuine response to that, a celebration. And Ion has said that the last time anything Ionic showed up was in the 60s. Ion does not knock the basic ground of what happened in the 60s. He says it was a great feeling, liberation, but of course they didn't understand that they had to go through the Android meme replay of that. And then Ion is the anti-environment to that. So the MKUltra mind conditioning, that was what was left over in the 70s and 80s. Even Dave Worster used to talk about that. He said, there'll be a reaction to this thing. So you had this breakthrough, and then humans, in a way, a lot of them couldn't take it, and they went reactionary, and that's what we put up for 30 years. And then that collapsed, and now it's wide open again, and now Ion's here. So people were not responding to an MKUltra at the time. They're responding to an in-depth thing inside themselves that had happened, and the information leaders in the news that made the word, that made the market, they, in after effect, had to come up with an explanation. Oh, we did this, we did that. That's where Walter Bowert regretted what he wrote. He realized that, yes, MKUltra was intended by the government, and they tried to do it, and they failed. And he made too much of it in his book. And he said, I wish I hadn't have done that, because now we got these idiots running around talking about and fearing MKUltra and all this bullshit that Alex Jones and all these guys, there's a whole industry around it, that Walter started. He knew through me and Reed McLuhan and that it was not that way actually in the 60s.
An insight that Marshall had that I learned from you, Bob, and that's the idea that as technology extends all of the senses, both outer and inner senses, it does so sort of out of proportion, amplifying the visual or amplifying the acoustic out of proportion to the visual and so on. But then in the 1960s, there was this period where the media ecology was such that our extensions were proportionally in relation to each other in such a way as to allow for the liberation of consciousness. And then tactility started to become too much, and we went back into a state of imbalanced consciousness.
Yeah. McLuhan said by the mid-60s, we had a new awareness around the planet because people had so many new technologies, and each technology in the slower phases would create a culture. If you got a lot of them coming down, no culture that a technology would create lasts 10 years. The Hitler world, radio world lasts 10 years. Then a totally different world comes in with TV. So after a while, by 1966, McLuhan was saying, people are not getting hypnotized by the culture anymore because there's too much going on and they can't get set in. So in that destabilized, detached, maybe confused state, they for the first time were not hypnotized by culture.
You see, there's probably a natural sort of equilibrium among the ratio of the senses when we're in harmony, in accord with the real world. And I think that we reached that ecology or that equilibrium in our media dynamics actually fell into that pattern momentarily. And that's what released the consciousness and the creativity.
Yeah, he said that. It wasn't that we were in harmony. He describes and understanding media that the modern person goes to TV, then goes listens to radio, then watches a movie, then reads a newspaper, then reads a book, then engages in conversation, then goes back and watches TV. The rotating through media was a pretty ideal state if you're looking at people not getting trapped in any one modality.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about individuals. I'm talking about just the collective matrix. Now, you're going to have individuals doing all kinds of different things in accord and out of accord, or fighting it or surrendering to it or what have you. But, you know, Marshall was always talking about the mass man. He wasn't really talking about the individual.
Right. You talk about the environments. So, yeah, so the environments are bouncing themselves off. But then eventually you get into the Reagan era, the beginning of the digital, and hyper-tactility.
Yeah, but before that, you got into the Camelot when everything was just balanced just right so that we could have a renaissance. But then media dynamics became distorted again. Tactility became out of proportion with
Here's how to say it, Scott. Here's how to say it. When tactility got extended too much, it pushed into hyperkineticism. And the hyperkineticism is the neocon revolution, which came in with Reagan. It's right there in laws of media.
Isn't that Croker's panic issues?
Yeah, panic kineticism. Everybody just moving fast, making the economy go faster. You know, the digital speed up. That was what McLuhan says right in laws of media.
We fell prey to the illusion of time and that there was not enough time and we had to hurry up and get it done because we're running out of time.
No, it was more the kinetic sense, it's kinetic. Think of what kinetic is and what is an extension of the kinetic.
Yeah, but if it's frantic and it's a panic, it's like we got to do something now because there's no time to think. We just have to act.
And you know how they acted? They started taking cocaine. Cocaine decisions, Zappa wrote.
I just think that during the Camelot period, the taste of eternity was there for a moment. That exploded the creative juices.
Hey, with the television environment as art form, the harmony of the black and white TV before the satellite Sputnik environment became prominent. That comes in with Telstar, 1962. And look at that. Telstar comes in 62. There's a song about it, and that's right when they're planning to kill Kennedy. It takes about a year, and they kill him in 63. So the TV thing, you know, only lasted 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, like you said, Kennedy's charisma became too powerful, and it scared
right.
the shit out of people who were trying to control.
It was the figure of Kennedy for the TV ground. It was the TV that was, it was many other things going on besides Kennedy on TV. So you had this charisma happening in the TV and media, and that threatened Big Brother. And they didn't realize, oh, they could have just sit back and said, well, as soon as the satellite environment comes into awareness, people will move out of the TV effect. If they didn't shoot Kennedy, you still would have had the change in mood in the later 60s caused by the increasing satellite environment.
Prior to Kennedy, you had live television broadcasts, so that couldn't be controlled. Once
they
could pre-record television, then you could take the risk out of the live broadcast. That live broadcast, that was the highest decibels of human consciousness, or of not human consciousness, but of consciousness, like Marshall said.
Yeah, that was super angelization. Super angels.
Because all television was broadcast live in the beginning. Anybody could come and do anything they wanted to, which was highly threatening to people who had special interests to protect.
Literate people who thought, if you say something, it'll change people. They thought a message from here to there, a content message, something to say, would affect people. They didn't know that that wouldn't work anymore. I mean, right in the middle of all this, McLuhan says Madison Avenue couldn't condition a mouse. Talk about MK Ultra. He recognized nobody could be conditioned anymore. Now, that was what was frightening. And so in the kinetic panic period, you have all these attempts to re-hypnotize people by having special effects movies, by having celebrity culture, endless nonsense being celebrated. That was an attempt to grab people back into being inside a box. It didn't work.
Well, that's why George Orwell and MK Ultra were doomed to fail on any large scale.
Yeah.
You could implement it on small scales, but not on the global scale.
Right. The small scale would just be what had already been done by secret groups anyways. that's just working with tribal fear or neighborhood fear. Hey, Bert, you have anything to say?
Well, actually, I was surfing your diaries. I saw Carolyn had a Carlos Castaneda connection.
Right, I put that in there. What do I say? I mean, I wasn't allowed to give away too much.
A person contacted Carolyn regarding a Carlos Castaneda meeting.
Yeah. The guy told Carolyn, you know, don't tell anybody. She didn't. She's a loyal person. When I said, I'm going to do it, she said, no, come on. You know, she's still loyal to the guy 30 years later. You know what I mean? The guy's probably dead.
But I find it interesting that Carolyn was invited to all man council or whatever. That makes a point.
Yeah, Carlos and the other guy were younger. Now, these guys, they thought they were cosmic. They solved the world's problems. They had to do with whatever they did in their magic to hold the world together. And it sounded like being with Dave Worster and Vern Christensen. But these guys were serious, you know, whatever they are, first Aboriginal people. But Carlos and his friend thought, we need woman energy in here. I mean, this is by the 80s, right? This is pretty late. They definitely thought Carolyn had something. Of course, Carolyn impresses everybody, so they thought Carolyn would be the perfect person to do it. And if I remember, there was a stalling. These old guys couldn't do it. They thought about it, tried it, but they said, nah. And either they're still holding the world together, and they know that women are a fucking danger. Women are just like Eve, you know, just from her ribs and her fucking something to be seriously avoided. Or they didn't make it and lost and died. And we don't know. It's interesting. And the guy that did it, he's in Toronto. He could get in touch with Carol any time. He seriously withdrew for some reason.
Bob,
so what else, Bert?
Here?
Magnetically influenced homeopathic remedies. And the amazing story to that is it was patented. There's a patent for it in the patent world. In 2008 or so, before ION, I sent JW the patent to explain him so he could understand Mir. A little while later, he said, Bob, you won't believe, behind the Mir patent, in some weird way, was the Coldplay formula that he had been working with some people in the 90s. In other words, their incomplete patent attempt at cold fusion, influenced by Pons and Fleischmann, whatever document they had registered, was stuck to the Mir document. So when he went and looked for the Mir document, there's this fucking document, and that's fucking unbelievable. It's still a mystery. I still say, how the fuck did that happen? And when he told me that in 2008, I didn't know what the fuck he was talking about. I just ignored it. But once we got the Coldplay formula and we started to patent it in 2010 and 11, then JW brought that whole thing up and talked about what was in the patent, what they had attempted, and then how we were totally beyond that or a whole new level to it. In some ways, you know, JW was energizing that already in his life. By working with some other rich people and trying to make some cold fusion. But why would that? Well, Jesus, somebody put it there to shock him. It was almost like JW had to be shocked with these incidents to recognize that he should stay in touch with us, because there was no reason for us to continue being friends in 2007, 2008, 2009. I mean, we weren't doing anything together, really. Just like talking to him. But, you know, Neufeld was here around. He arrived on February 22nd, I think, 2009. Or it was the following February 28th, 2009. And JW calls up, and he asks me, what is the Android meme? It was the first time he ever asked me about anything I was saying, other than when I first talked to him in 2006 when he was asking me, what is tactility? And that was the reason he originally got in touch with me. So I explained him the Android meme. That's the end of February, and Ayn's going to show up 3 weeks later. That led to some interesting conversation for the next couple of weeks, and then led to Dr. Beter coming. But I always thought it was interesting that Neufeld was sitting here, the guy who made the albums was sitting here, when the phone call came in, where now JW was asking me something, because you didn't tell him anything, you know. He had nothing to learn, he thought.
Isn't it interesting you said that Ion mentioned that the 60s, that 60s movement was not something that was...
It was genuine.
It was something serious. It was genuine. And didn't Ion also say that you and Carolyn were ready 40 years ago, but...
Yes, we were ready in 69.
So wasn't that around the same time?
Yeah, we can blame the next 40 years on me and Carolyn. We fucking stopped it. We decided, nah, we're going to take the Emmaus Road the long way around. I'm going to just go around and talk to people. I just want to talk to Jesus. Go on the road with him and talk to him. So I went around to all the fragments of Jesus. Frank Zappa, McLuhan, LaRouche, Mabe Russell, all the holy offices were fragments of Jesus. That was my conversation with great people. And then we went to New York, the heart of the Android meme, watched it die. Then they fucking hit the punchline, you know, September 11th. And then we're sitting there on City Island. And the world said, well, you waited long enough, Bob. Time's up. Get your fucking ass in there. Here we go. First of all, was Eddie saying, hey, you want to build a medical center down? And you want a medical center in Costa Rica? Yeah, that sounds good. JW said to get the hell out of New York. That's 2007. So, we're planning it in Maui. Okay, we'll come over and plan it and live in Maui for a couple weeks. So Carol stayed 5 weeks. I got bored and said, fuck this. I'm going to New Zealand. I've never been to New Zealand. So I went to New Zealand to visit Andy Crystal. Came back to L.A. Christmas Eve. Met with James Martinez. I remember Carolyn came and just sat in the background. James told me later, he was checking me out whether it was his second time with me, though he'd been phone buddies for years. He says to me, you know, Carolyn's cool. I said, yep, yeah, Carolyn's cool. So that passed his test, if there was one. So then we went back to New York, and a week or so later, James said, why don't you come on my show and be a regular guest? And so we started on January 16th, 2008. And then a few weeks later, he said, what the fuck are you doing in New York? Let's go back to Maui. So we go back to Maui in June 2008, and then September 2008, the economy collapses. The people who were going to build the thing in Costa Rica couldn't do it anymore. So we just stayed there in Maui, and then Ion showed up in March, and we knew. Lockdown Bob Rule was going to be a fact.
I was just going to ask about the 60s. I mean, the whole reason Ion was able to come forth, I thought also publicly, was because the whole Internet environment was big enough to encompass that. And that wasn't in place back in the 60s.
Look at this, Susanna. Worcester was saying in 67 that Rye turned a plane of essence. There's only one person in the world even entertained the notion that that was not balderdash, and that was me. So I thought about it for all those years. And then Ion comes along, and we're talking to Ion one day, well into talking to Ion, like within the first year, and somehow we get into this kind of conversation. And Ion says there was a genuine something, a human something, breakthrough in the 60s, and Ion was not prone to say stuff like that. Nothing impressed Ion. Everything was a fucking waste of time until Ion showed up. And so I thought it was incredible that they complimented, sort of said there was an interesting breakthrough that didn't have any staying power, or it didn't happen, or it wasn't supposed to happen. It was just the beginning. Then I thought, shit, fucking Worcester was right. You know what I mean? That it validated what cosmic awareness was saying. It wasn't due to the technology. It was a deeper thing in humanity because it's not involved in time. And I try to write about it in the Up the Orphic Ante about, 57 to 67 is the period when the satellite is the hidden environment. And from 67 to 77, we start to become aware of the satellite environment. It's the older environment. It's a new Android meme thing, a digital thing starts to take over. So the collapse of the last principality of the spaceship perspective over the planet, it dies in 67. That's an external manifestation of an inner plane thing. And that inner plane level of Rye return to essence is the level that Ion's saying. Because Ion's saying this is not 2015. This is a moment in the non-time where humans said we're going to fucking get our shit together. Now, you look around the world. It's interesting. Symbolically, you have the beast, the Internet, and all that shit killing everybody on one level. It has to be this time. So the technology had to get there. So Ion, because they're not for technology, they don't seem to understand the second phase of the afterimage of the Android meme, or if machines, extending machines had to happen after we had extended our bodies. So it was natural to go from 69 to 2009, and that movie that's out right now, Inherent Vice, is about 1969. Do they show the guy, Scott, doing the computer hookups at UCLA that's in the novel?
No.
They probably don't even know. We're going to have to redo that movie, do it properly, because that starts the weekend of the apex of polarity, September 5th, 69, Dweezil Zappa's birthday. That's when Worcester has that conference, and it's pretty significant. And that's the weekend they started to hook up the Internet, where the computer in UCLA dialed the one up in San Francisco or someplace. Then they made another connection in October, another connection the 1st of November, and a fourth one in December, and went over to MIT, and that was the beginning of the Internet. And that's discussed in Inherent Vice. The creepy guy running it is saying where the police are going to use it. It was being set up as a police data collection thing.
Was Sputnik the initiation of the solar government phase?
Yes. Before World War II, there was, you know, a world government. The rocket race start, take over, and the global communications got better. That's what I'm calling the solar government. In actual fact, they are an elite within the world government, if you were more practical about it and dumb. I call it the solar government because it was responding to the planetary structure that was being surrounded by satellites. So that's really what we were, the Secret Council 10. We were floating above the world government.
Was Robert Anton Wilson into McLuhan even?
A little bit.
Leary knew about him. Robert Anton Wilson did a really great tape. I know you don't think much of it, but he did a good commentary on Finnegan's Wake. It wasn't McLuhan style, but it was, you know.
Let me explain that, Scott. He came to Toronto in 1985, and I didn't know about him. I don't think I knew about him. But I heard all the young kids at CKL were going to go see this new mind, this new intellectual. And I knew they should be listening to me. So I said, who the fuck's this guy? They don't recognize me. Go see this idiot. So I went up there to the Toronto Library, and there's Robert Anton Wilson. He starts talking. He does his sort of corny, semi-Bucky Fuller stuff. It wasn't that impressive. It is impressive that he would talk about Bucky Fuller and Finnegan's Wake, and this and that, you know what I mean? He was hip for the Generation Xers. That was okay. So in the question period, I brought up McLuhan. And he says, well, I knew about McLuhan. I read his book in 1948, Mechanical Bride. I said, the book didn't come out until 1951. How'd you do that? He says, I don't know. And so I started to call him on a few things that he was saying. And he quickly learned to fucking stop answering me and listen to other people. So I had it in for him. Then I got a hold of Cosmic Trigger. That's the fourth book of his Illuminatus trilogy. In it, he criticizes May Brussel. So I said, that's not going to go. And I talked to May about him, and she didn't like him. So I was waiting for my opportunity to get him, and it happened on May 29th, 1993, the first time I was on KPFK and David Porter's Genesis of a Music. And I played it before. It's right there on my archive. In our battle, he faints. I win.
I know. I heard that show. I thought, what an honor. Robert Anton Wilson's calling into the show, and then you read him the Riot Act, and he doesn't even know how to respond.
No, what happened, Scott? The fake Robert Anton Wilson called in.
Yeah, I remember that first, but that was just an introduction.
The fake guy calls in, and I was listening to Roy of Hollywood's show. Monday night, he had Leary. They were leading up to the Millennium Madness on May 29th, 93 in L.A. with Leary, Krasner and all the guys. They were celebrating, 2000 coming. They had Leary on Monday. They had Thompson on Wednesday night. And then I was on Saturday. So I heard the fake Robert Anton Wilson talking to Robert Anton Wilson. So I got up on that. I caught up, and this is like 2 or 3 in the morning. Everybody, Jerry's asleep, Karen's asleep, but I'm on fucking duty. I'm monitoring the battle. I don't even know what's going to happen, but it's going to happen, so I'm monitoring it. So I realized the fake guy. Then I get on the show, my first show. The fake Robert Anton Wilson phones in, and pretty quickly I realize who he was. I don't know if I called him on it right away, but the guy started praising me, saying I was way better than the Church Sub Genius, way better than the real Robert Anton Wilson. And the guy basically said he wished he was me, but everybody thought it was Robert Anton Wilson saying this. But it wasn't, because when he hung up, And we get another call, and it's a guy who is sponsoring the Millennium Madness, and he complains. He said, you guys just had the fake Robert Anton Wilson. Now you're going to hear the real one. He's staying with me. We're going to do the Millennium Madness this afternoon. Here's Robert Anton Wilson. So he comes on, and then all of history had converged to this moment, which I hadn't even rehearsed for, but I was ready, and I immediately blasted Robert Anton Wilson. I blast him for fucking Mae Brussel. In other words, as soon as he showed up, the file popped up in my head, the whole list of grievances from 6 years before, and immediately I spewed them out. And then that threw him off, and then he got silly, and then I reminded him of the Toronto Library and how stupid he was there about McLuhan, and bang, 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 bang. He couldn't even rope-a-dope me. And so all of a sudden, the guy who called in and introduced him had the phone and said, I'm sorry, Robert fainted. Robert fell over. Robert's not available. So I said, well, yay, victory or whatever. And he says, don't celebrate too fast, Bob. We're watching you, Bob. We're going to get you. He ends with a fucking threat. It's all there on the timeline. You can hear it. I told the fake Robert Tom Wilson, he said, are you coming to the Millennium? Oh, yeah, I'll be there. So we were planning to meet there, but of course I didn't go. I went to the beach instead. So I didn't know that the real guy would call in right after the fake guy, and then we resolved the issues, knockout punch. If he had not called in, I probably would have gone to the Millennium Madness because I knew I had to confront Wilson because he was in the neighborhood, you know?
You could have been a little more diplomatic, Bob.
No. This is a family feud. This is years of grievance. It involves the Church Sub Genius. Remember, the Church Sub Genius says he's the J.R. Bob Dobbs when they're in a certain mood. They say he's me. So it is a battle. And it did come up, I think, in the dialogue. Someone, Dave Porter, said, well, are you J.R. Bob Dobbs? And he said, yes. Some people say, well, you're talking to the real J.R. Bob Dobbs. And he didn't know what to say to that. So it's all pretty funny. And it was Guffey, Robert Guffey from The Guff, heard that interview. Robert Anton Wilson, he was a young kid, and Wilson was his hero, and he couldn't believe that someone knocked him out. So he got fascinated by me, and that's led to that article in 2000 in Paranormal Magazine saying The Matrix was about me. It's because little Robert Guffey heard that May 29th, 93 encounter and saw his hero blasted off the planet. And here I am sitting in my victory lap. This whole fucking last 4 or 5 years has been one constant verbal victory lap. I've been boasting for 5 years now.
I was surfing your diaries looking for your last engagement with Tom Wolfe, and I came across the February 25th, 1999, where you confronted him at Fordham. I was wondering, has he engaged you since 99?
No, he doesn't engage with the McLuhan world. He just does his novel world, you know. He just goes and hides and researches his next novel. He showed up lately with something. I saw him being interviewed. He's pretty old now. What did he comment on? Oh, yeah, he did that great article I sent around.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's where I read that.
Good article. Masters of the Universe. See, he's good at sort of giving you semi-inside information in a nice, friendly pattern and lays it out and makes fun of them and gives you the name of the players. You know, that's a very good article he did.
I saw in your diary where William Irvin Thompson called you the man from Lemuria.
Yeah.
Is there something that you said to him that caused him to call you that?
He doesn't call me Lemurian. I say it.
You say that. Okay.
Yeah, this is November 2nd, 1972, in New York. Thompson has left York University around that time. He's decided to quit being a teacher in Toronto and setting up the Lindisfarne. So I bumped into him at that point. And he was into sacred geometry or something like that. He was sort of taking McLuhan and going back into mathematics with mystical mandalas. So he says, there's a new geometry afoot. I said, does it retrieve the culture of Atlantis? And he says, perhaps. And I say, well, I think we're living in the culture geometry of Lemuria. What that means is Atlantis is the 22 land, Lemuria is the 14. You'll see that on my chart. The Thompson quadrant is Atlantis, and the Croker quadrant is Lemuria. The Lemurians, the elite, could not see anybody below them. Atlantis was just more technocracy. So there's a division there, and I'm saying that Atlantis resonates more with pre-Sputnik pre-satellite, pre-60s reality, and the virtual class is coming in, and I'm calling that the geometry of Lemuria. It deals with the fact that the virtual class does not connect with the working classes. So it's a geometry based on that, not on the geometry of at least a residue of visual space that you get in Atlantis. So that's what that's about. Now, he goes on to write a lot about Atlantis. He does a novel on Atlantis. He never really gets to Lemuria. So my statement stands tall, and he never found out what I meant. Now you go to December 16, 1978, my second encounter. It's all fucking explained. December 16, 78, New York again. Now I know more about him. He wasn't anybody in 72. He had put out that book, Edge of History. I might have seen him at the McLuhan seminar, the famous encounter he had with McLuhan one night. That was around 72, I think. He hadn't really established identity, but by 78 he did. He had written some books, and Lindisfarne was going strong. So I go, Mr. Thompson. So I attended one of their seminars. I found your seminar very stimulating. William Irwin Thompson, thank you. I noticed you during it, and I thought you looked strangely familiar. Yes, he had encountered me in 72 and probably saw me at McLuhan's. So I go, yes. So we met about 6 years ago when you first came to New York from your retreat in Toronto. We discussed the resonance of the Atlantean metaphor for our times. And, secretly I thought the Lemurian was. So he goes, oh, yes, I remember that because you emphasized Lemuria. And I've never been able to get your point. I've actually puzzled over it several times since then. And I say, politely, shall I attempt to explain it again? Actually, I had not explained it back then. Shall I attempt to explain it again? He says, be my guest. I go, according to my sources, the Lemurian culture in the Pacific Ocean about 18,000 years ago was so stratified that the king and his immediate circle could not see the citizens who lived below them. The king literally could not see them. So, for example, if a bridge collapsed, the king would request the bridge to reappear. Eventually, when the bridge was rebuilt, he thought he had manifested it because he couldn't see the engineers who had actually done the job. Thompson says, that's an original idea. Now, how does it relate to Atlantis and today? I say, if we accept my description of Lemuria and the standard mythic image of Atlantis, then the current mixed corporate media oligarchy centered in Los Angeles and New York is more like Lemuria because that simulated world, or virtual world, can't recognize the world of industrial hardware and flesh. It can't stop and acknowledge what it does to those lost worlds or how it exploits them. Thompson says, well, you've made your metaphor clearer, but I'm going to have to digest this for a little while. Let's talk about it later. Now, here comes a descriptive thing. End of conversation with that. Let's talk about it later. Then it says, just at that moment, Gregory Bateson came over to Thompson, nodded knowingly at Bob, and escorted Thompson over to the other side of the room for a private tête-à-tête. Bob turned and bumped into Margaret Lloyd, a regular at the Lindisfarne seminars, who was the seventh-generation direct descendant on the female side of Benjamin Franklin. And remember, we played her session with the Evergreens talking about Ben Franklin. Now, here's the significant point. That's December 16th. The next day, I'm with Thompson's enemy, LaRouche. I said, Lynn, have you ever noticed that the central feature of all machines is rotation? LaRouche, who was interested in that kind of stuff, he developed this years later. He goes, now that's a mouthful, Bob. I'll have to think about such a sweeping generalization. But my first impression is it has the ring of fact. I've been so busy with our new book, Dope Inc., I haven't had time to think about those kinds of patterns the past year. But I think such an idea gives me a little jolt in the direction I should now go to clear my head of our drug war work. Once again, Bob, thanks for the door to fresh air. See, all the holy offices, they like me. I show up, give them a little hint. Planting seeds, Santa Clausing all over the place. That's December 17th. The next one is me and Beater, February 6th, 79. That's interesting. Then me and Flaps, who I sent into the LaRouche cult. Here's a good one. Jean de Saltzman. She's the inheritor of the Gurdjieff legacy. When he died in 49 or so, or according to Ion, he didn't. I don't think he did die. He was from another world or something, like Sun Ra. But Jean de Saltzman was the woman who took over the Gurdjieff organization, who Jim George, the guy who got us into Mir, back in 1990, he went to Paris and met Saltzman about 6 months after Gurdjieff died, just missed meeting Gurdjieff, and then was very prominent in the New York faction of the Gurdjieff world from that point on, 50s on. So Gene DeSalzman says, Mr. Dobbs, in the few times I've heard you talk privately to Krishnamurti, I'm always struck that you bring full sentences out of him. He doesn't mumble symbols shyly as he usually does in private conversation. He even uses the word I when he talks to you. Do you realize how unusual that is? I go, I don't think so. He's always talked that way around me, which is the same way he talked to my father years ago when I first met Mr. Judo through Rene being my father. Salzman, so your father is to blame? I said, I hope so. That's April 2nd, 79 in Switzerland. Now, Bob is back in L.A. with Zappa. Let's see what we say in August 28, 79. Frank, you hit the nail on the head with that theme of banning music in Joe's garage. And Zappa says, yeah, look at what the Ayatollah is doing in Iran. That was right when the Ayatollah took over Iran in early 79. And they banned Western music, which was this theme that Frank had in his albums in 79 with the mini opera Joe's Garage. So I'm congratulating him on that. And he goes, oh, yes, but I want to warn you, there's going to be a rise in fundamentalist political activity here in America, mainly through the Republican Party, over the next few years. Your scenario will look more like the news than science fiction. Zappa says, if you're right, then those are some of my worst fears come true. I say, it's unfortunate, but it's going to knock the wind out of a lot of the mood of electric autonomy that motivated much of the frenzy of the 70s. That would be partly of the vibe of the 60s that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
So the counter-reaction sets in. So then I say Frank turned back to his editing console, but he also turned on his television to catch the news. He's a great consumer of news. The thing is there, when he puts out his autobiography 10 years later, he talks about the guy who turned him on to the fundamentalists just before Reagan got in and how that gave him the heads up. It's all through the 80s he was warning about the moral majority before the moral majority sort of even anybody knew about. Just that Frank knew that Reagan was going to bring him in. He never says who he got that information from, but this is where he got it. He got it for me, August 28, 1979.
He had to turn back to his palate, the news. He was using what was going on as his ability to make his painting or whatever you want to call it.
His journalism.
Art.
He always said that he was a journalist. And he would turn how people would think was visual news, he'd turn into a musical composition. That was what he did. Yeah, you're right. He monitored the mixed corporate media, picked up the rhythms, and then made his music around the news. And look at this. Here's Garrett, October 14, 79, in Dallas. I'm on the phone. Garrett, if I fly up to Dartmouth, will you go to Apocalypse Now with me? Garrett says, no, Bob, I will not go to a movie that treats the word apocalypse so casually. Now, I want to lay out something serious. This is for serious students like Burp. After the Garrett, October 14, 79, December 9, 79 in Sydney, Australia. Now, this is heavy, Burt. This is me talking to Michael Hand. You don't know who that is, but watch this. Michael, to put it bluntly and quickly, you're being transferred. The Nugan Hand Bank is obsolete and is going to be made a public victim. Accept it, because the 80s are going to be a different ball game. So that's 79, and I'm telling him, you got to do something different. It's not working. He says, Frank Nugan won't accept this. I say, he will, actively or passively, either way. He has no choice in the matter. As for you, Trenton Parker will be in contact shortly. He'll assist you. And that's it. Don't try to contact me. I will find you. Well, within a few months, Mr. fucking Michael Hand and Frank Nugan are found dead. And that became a huge scandal, and that's when I met May Brussel, and I turned her on to the hidden ground to death of the Nugan Hand Bank, and that put her ahead of everybody in the 80s.
Damn.
Yeah, so that's serious shit there. That's top-down stuff. That's the guy you saw visiting James on the video. So, December 17th. This is a few days after the Nugan Hand problem. You can Google that. That's a big story. Look up and read about the Nugan Hand Bank, 1980. So a few days later, I'm in Rome, and I'm talking to Licio Gelli, who's the fucking head guy of all this shit. Licio sent me to get LaRouche going in 66, and I was not as high up as Jelly was then. But now at 79, it's completely different. I can tell Licio what to do. So I say, if you don't clean up this Tony Negri matter very soon, you're going to be culta non grata. I said culta. In other words, a cult non grata. You know, persona non grata. Well, this guy would be culta non grata. Now, he's pissed because he's kind of losing it. And he goes, I'm tempted to tell you and your people to go fuck yourselves. He's telling me this a year after he's killed the 30-day Pope in September 78. So this is the guy that Godfather 3 is about. Now, Licio Gelli's the guy who kills the Pope. So let's just go back. I say to that guy, you fucking murderer, if you don't clean up this Tony Negri matter very soon, you're going to be culta non grata. He says, I'm tempted to tell you and your people to go fuck yourselves. I go, look, your role in the old world government apparatus is pretty tenuous right now because we've got bigger problems in the solar government structure. Now, the solar government is really starting to fall apart. This is 15 years after my father warned me, right? So Jelly says, that doesn't concern me. And I go, oh, yeah? And so then we have him. Jelly then turned on his VCR and picked up the telephone as Bob watched the opening scenes of The Godfather Part 2 unfold on the screen. And Godfather 3 is going to be about Licio, and I'm watching Godfather 2 on his fucking VCR. He didn't know that he'd be fucking exposed 10 years later. The book that exposed him was In God's Name, came out in 1984 by a British journalist, David Yalop, I think his name was, and that's what Coppola made Part 3 on, based on that book. Here's Jelly in 79. He's fucking going down, but he can't believe it. And then, if you guys heard of the P2 arrest in Italy in the spring of 81, just before the Pope was shot, that's where the shit started to happen. The Pope gets shot. And then Jelly and P2 are exposed, and Jelly's on the run ever since, from that point on. Zappa talks about the Banco Ambrosiano in his play, Them or Us, I think it's called, so he makes a reference to that. The Banco Ambrosiano. See, Jelly kills Roberto Calvi, the banker in London, hanging from Blackfriars Bridge. You can look it up. It's a major archetype of the last 25 years. It tells a lot about the hidden part of the Vatican, the Mafia, the CIA, and everything. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, the new Pope, I didn't know this, he announced that the Vatican is going to accept Darwin. We said recently, I don't know if we said it on the air or I played it, this Pope is trying definitely to catch up with us. I mean, this is the hip Pope. He's a nice Pope or something. And back to the basic values. But he's doing his damnedest to keep the Vatican relevant to what we're doing. And I didn't know that he's getting desperate. They're now, like, going non-Catholic.
Yeah.
We're not Catholic. We reject all that. We're Darwinian. We believe in Rupert Sheldrake's morphic genesis, morphogenic resonance, whatever it is. The morphogenic field, we believe in that.
Well, apparently the Pope gave all the cardinals quite a tongue-lashing during some speech that was a New Year's Day or beginning of the year thing about how focused they were on having big houses and lots of money and not serving the people.
He has to because they have no money. I had talked about the big conclave about 3 years ago down in Panama where the previous Pope told them, you got to start acting like priests again. We don't have any money. So that sounds like a replay of that, what you're saying, what we heard about 3 years ago. Yeah, they got to clean up their act because they got nothing to work with. So here's a funny one. This is Carolyn talking to Sue Bone's opposite, Sky Goddess Sue's opposite. But I've named it as Sue. So this never happened to Sue. And it would never happen, and it's obvious when you read this, but I have it as if Sue is the one experiencing this. So look at this. This is December 30th, 79. Now, what's interesting about this, on December 31st, 79, Sue Bone in Halifax actually read Operation Mind Control. She didn't go out New Year's Eve. We went out, and I had found it in a secondhand bookstore. You just couldn't find it, and I found it in a secondhand bookstore in Halifax in the afternoon of December 31st, so I gave it to Sue to read, and we get home about 4 or 5 in the morning, and she's still awake reading the book, totally amazed. Holy fuck, you know? And that woke Sue up. So this is the day I put that date in because Sue knows the importance of December 31st, 79. So jokingly, I have her being like this other person the day before. So she goes, Connie, I haven't seen you and Bob in so long. I just had to come to Toronto to spend the holidays with you. But there's another reason I want to be with you. Oh, says Carolyn. Sue, as you know, after you and Bob left Halifax, I got into the Bible and became a born-again Christian. However, I discovered something about 6 months ago that's changed me a little. Have you ever heard of the Worldwide Church of God? Carolyn says, yes, that's the guy on the radio. What's his name? Garner Ten Armstrong, right? She says, yeah, you're partly correct. He's not on the radio anymore because he was removed from the church by his father, Herbert W. Armstrong, who started the ministry back in the 30s. Herbert Armstrong has replaced Garner Ted on the radio, and he's also on television now. Carolyn says, I see. Now, Carolyn knows all about him. She helped fund him in Radio Luxembourg in 1954 to get him going in Europe. So she's pretending she's going, what's his name? Garner Ted Armstrong? Is that who it is? So here's Carolyn lying her fucking mouth off. She says, I see. I actually haven't heard either of them in years. Sue says, neither had I. And then I found Herbert Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain Prophecy. I read it, and it shook me up. It turns out I was not a real Christian. Carolyn goes, knowing this whole rigmarole, go, oh, why not? Sue says, real Christians observe the Sabbath on Saturday. They don't celebrate Christmas on December 25th. That's a pagan holiday, and so is Easter Sunday. The true church is very serious and particular about how one practices the rituals of being a Christian. It has great respect for the traditions set out in the Old Testament. The New Testament fulfills the Old Testament. I never realized how important these issues were for the Christians till I read this book. I was hoping you would take this copy I brought for you and Bob, and maybe you'll find the time to read it. Carolyn says, this is a gift from you, Sue. We'll certainly read it. I'm honored that you thought of us, but that explains why you didn't come to our Christmas dinner. Sue says, yes, we're living in a dark time, so we have to know how to be a light in the world. That's what I'm committed to. And Sue did not know that we funded the publication of that fucking book.
You didn't know how appropriate it was to fund a book that talked about prophecy in the Bible. Now that
yeah,
we
I
have
did.
Ion and the Revelation.
Wow. I thought it was a bunch of shit, man. Like nonsense. It's a good point. Yes, I had to learn. I had my comeuppance waiting for me. What?
Come on.
30 years later. No, 31, because we don't find out. No, we knew a bit about 2009, but really didn't get it until 2010. So 31 years later, I get nailed. Remember Ryan used to say, did you hear that, people? We got Bob quoting scripture.
Yeah, but you only got interested because Ion showed you how it was riddled with Dobstown.
That's right. I thought it was all about me. Oh, okay. I'll read this fucker.
I haven't even jokes about that. Your chart's in there, Bob.
No, it's true. It is about me. That's Ophanel Hobab.
I would like to ask you something. Here on the cover, it says, the winner is the one who knows when to drop out.
Yes.
So what would he mean with that?
Okay, so in the TV Android meme world, there's no conclusion. You can get into debate, win a little, but you'll eventually lose because the other faction will come up with some line that the TV likes and they'll celebrate it. So they're saying you can't win on the argument mind level of making a valid point. You have to know when to drop out and not engage in the debate. You don't stay in there hoping that your point will dominate. If you know that no point can be the finish line, you know when you've run your course, said your weird stuff, made a few pattern insights, you know, altered the debate, then you get the hell out of there because it's not, in the end, going to be of any consequence.
Bob, I still have questions on your January 4th, 80 post that you just read about the mythic government phase, that the national world and solar governments were essentially over.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything to talk about anymore, and it was only those that knew that got out of that game and moved on.
Right. The mythic government is the Reagan era, where it's just a comfortable image where the guy doesn't speak, he just waves. He waves and acts friendly and reminds you of the small town you came from. So it was getting more and more hard for people to think the world has still had human scale. So the Android meme had to present the image that there was human scale, and that's what Reagan's early image was. He was going to make mourning in America.
just a big friendly smile.
Friendly smile, the cloned mouth. And it's mythic in a sense. It's a, there is the reality of the hologram of the United States. And mythic doesn't mean false. It means totalistic, the whole pattern. Because for primitive pre-litter people, the myths they told each other were very big and comprehensive and cosmic stories. McLuhan defined that as total, whereas Western man has literate fragmented knowledge with different subjects and disciplines, and they don't have a big picture. They don't present the process of the big picture. So the mythic government phase is a technical statement.
He was the myth himself, the cowboy actor propped up as president of the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah, a mythic image.
McLuhan talks about now the Western wasn't a stupid pop culture. The Western was very dramatic because in the new post-electric age, people didn't know how to have an identity. It was hard to get an identity. And when nobody has an identity, the only way you can assert yourself is to be violent. So everybody was on the frontier, no matter where they were, and the Western in the 50s was an expression of that. Nobody had an identity. You had to be tough, and you had to forge something every day. So we were living on the Western. That becomes a bonanza. So Reagan as the cowboy image was the last Western appropriate mythic image to represent the Western dynamism of forging an identity in a world that didn't allow an identity to stay very long.
Now, that was being propped up, but there was a whole bunch going on behind the scenes. I've been getting into Mae Brussel. When Reagan came in, the government was essentially taken over. The Pentagon was taken over.
That's the Bolsheviks.
And so your next post, June 30th of 80, your LaRouche and Flapp says to watch for the growing influence of the Orthodox Church in Moscow. There was a turnover in control in Russia and a turnover in control in the United States during that period.
The native Russians, the Skopje, brought back the church to stop the influence of Bolshevism, who had been kicked out of the Soviet Union. The new church guys were getting ready to allow the wall to go down. They made an agreement with Germany in West Germany in 1983, what eventually happened in 89. That's why in 88 I was able to predict that Germany would be reunited when nobody was saying that. There was only one or two of us who made that prediction.
What about the connection with Reagan and the Pope?
Well, there were a lot of Knights of Malta, like Al Haig, in his cabinet. That was the big thing. And that was all part of the battle over Poland, which was the Christian Russians fighting against the Bolsheviks to dismantle the Soviet Union. And the first cracks in that were in Poland with the Solidarity Movement. Pope John Paul II was very active in that, and that propped up his image. Now, May, not looking at it on the beater level, she just saw that there was a lot of interaction between the Knights of Malta in the American cabinet, in the Vatican, and in Poland. And she saw that as the Fourth Reich. So she was seeing it as a following of the Rockefeller Nazi Combine, I.G. Farben. She didn't know about the Bolshevik Skopje confusion factor.
So she was following the money.
Yeah. May was obsolete in relation to Beater. But you wouldn't believe Beater, too fantastic, so you have to know May to get the basics of why there was a secret war going on. You know,
wow.
And May was very good to put it practical for you. Then you would read LaRouche, would intellectualize it, and then you'd get to the extreme Beater level. Now, LaRouche was against the church rising in Moscow, so he called it the Third Rome Plan, make Moscow the Third Rome. And Flaps, who's a LaRouche, he's interpreting Beater stuff on the LaRouche level, and that's a little higher than Mae Brussel, but not as accurate as Beater.
But you have to imagine at that time all these players had their desires in place, even if they didn't come to fruition. I'm sure the Pope at that time had probably hoped for a greater connection with Russia as far as Rome went.
You're talking normal archetypes. You know, policies between the Vatican and that, yeah. But you're missing out the fact that the goddamn Pope was a robotoid.
You're saying that he was controlled from other places, and those other places were what, Mama?
It was a battle between individuals who used the mask of institutions to cover their personal power plans. Think what Beefheart said. There are 40 people in the world, and 5 of them are hamburgers. So there are 40 people, and that's Secret Council 10. There were 40 people in the votes. There's that small number of people arguing over which way the planet's going to go and its resources.
And fighting over it, too.
Yeah, individually.
And so people like Brussels, and there were a number of people that you were monitoring that had pieces of the puzzle or were putting pieces of the puzzle, of your puzzle together.
Yes. They were trying to figure me out. They didn't know I was involved in that level. They just thought I was a knowledgeable person helping them, and they didn't know that they were analyzing the very people that I was dealing with.
Man, you had a lot of different faces, Bob. You had to know where you were and who you were talking to at all times.
Right, and all I had to do was be friendly, be my natural self, just be a nice guy. That's all I had to do. I was like the guy who would turn it into a humor. I make them sort of see the fun of it, or the funniness, or the absurdity of it. Like, I've got recordings of me and May, you know, on the phone laughing our heads off, you know. That's what I'd do. I'd be someone that could talk intelligently about what they're interested in, and then have fun with it somehow. And those that could do it, you know, became good friends. Others didn't. I became a lot closer to May than LaRouche. LaRouche was pretty serious, you know. He was a funny guy, but he was a fanatic about his own purpose. He wanted to become one of those people in the conflict.
That gives a whole new meaning to different quadrants or different levels of information.
A quadrant is a figure in the ground. You have the figure of McLuhan, but he represents homeopathic TV in the Android meme. So when you're talking to McLuhan, you're talking to TV. When you're talking to LaRouche, you're talking to radio. When you're talking to Thompson, you're talking to computer. And when you're talking about the whole global theater matrix, you're talking to Croker. When you're talking about whatever
there's
it is categorizations that, you're talking to me.
Well, and you and I on last week were talking about states of emotion, too. You were arguing about Croker and LaRouche being the paranoia, the quadrant of paranoia.
Yeah. And panic and hysteria and schizophrenia.
Now, you're at the center of all these wonderful quadrants.
I was the first quadriphenic. I was the guy juggling the interplay. Like, McLuhan didn't know that I was involved with LaRouche. LaRouche didn't know I was involved with May or McLuhan. Croker didn't know I was involved with LaRouche. He did know I was involved with Thompson. He became aware because when I asked for copyright permission to have his quotes in my book, I told him that William Henry Thompson had never heard of him. And I was just thinking about this today, and he was surprised. What? He doesn't know about me? He was actually surprised. And I was thinking today, why did Croker think that Thompson should know about him? So, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Croker in detail about that, but that's a passing thought. So Croker did know about Thompson, and he knew about me and McLuhan, but he didn't know about LaRouche. Even though Croker wrote an article about LaRouche in 1970, categorizing him as a foster of paranoid politics.
What's the attraction? I get the attraction with McLuhan. There's obviously... there's knowledge there that the Fondi knew of that sent you on the trail. So Croker and the rest of them, what are you getting from that?
Only McLuhan and LaRouche are in the beginning. Alicia Jelly asked me to help LaRouche and find him some students. So that was in 66, 67. Thompson and Croker are way younger. They come after Rai's return to essence. They come in the later stages of the Android meme. Thompson was not assigned. McLuhan and LaRouche were assigned. Thompson and Croker were not assigned. So I just developed my own interest in Thompson because my friend Lawrence Rockefeller was funding him. So I wanted to find out, so why is Lawrence doing this? I found out basically Lawrence Rockefeller, of the five Rockefeller brothers,
was pretty guilty about what his brothers and he had done in the 50s and 60s. So he decided to, almost in a sense, start a religion. He's a major funder of the New Age, and he wanted to create a paradigm of some kind of alternative to what his brothers had represented and what the establishment represented. So he actually tried to undermine his own power structure. And Bill Thompson dedicated the book to him. He's a pretty nice guy. He's a pretty interesting guy. He tried to do what Cosmic Awareness predicted in 1976, that there was light coming through, quote, the old Illuminati, and they were starting to realize, we've got to do something differently. Lawrence was the only one of the brothers who made that shift. And he genuinely was trying to create alternative thinkings for people in the world of theology and religion. But he did it out of guilt. I mean, he knew his brother was involved with the Kennedy assassination, you know?
He saw what he saw and didn't like it and wanted something else?
He wasn't listening to Abrahams. He decided to develop a project. He didn't realize the uselessness of a project.
Well, he developed his own Abrahams, didn't he? He developed his own project.
Yeah, he actually laid down some of the memes that Abrahams developed. Thompson is one of the originators of the New Age world. You know, you have to go back. He was there very early and funded by Lawrence.